Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. PRN is indeed moving forward. I'm proud to be part of an operation that is the leading online news and information service. The programming on PRN is the type that people need to listen to follow, to tell their friends about, and to stick with and stay away from you-know-what. You've heard it enough on this program. John McMurtry is my guest today. It's always great to have John back to exchange comments and analysis and ideas on the most important issues we need to be thinking about, acting about, and of course always telling others, because if you don't spread the word and let others know what you found out, there's no other way we're going to get the change that we need to get, and we certainly know we're close to getting it now, and that really is what bothers me the most. I never lose hope. I hope others won't either. There is always hope for change. It's happened in the past. It's happened in America. It can happen again. I certainly hope it can. I'm committed to try to get it there. Let me just make a few comments before John jumps in. Yesterday I began the program mentioning Lynn Stewart. I just want to briefly mention again, regular listeners know that Lynn is wrongfully in prison. She's a longtime human rights defender. She's someone who deserves great honor, not imprisonment. She's one of thousands of American political prisoners. It's very serious with Lynn, more so than most others, because Lynn is ill. She has stage 4 cancer. She's dying. She's denied the treatment that she needs. She'll never get it unless she's released. There's what should be a virtually automatic compassionate release program. Lynn absolutely qualifies for it. It's not a debatable point. The only point is, will it or will it not be granted? Well, the prison warden recommended compassionate release. The Bureau of Prisons turned Lynn down. And Lynn, through her attorneys, had her day in court last week. And the trial judge, the federal district trial judge, who initially sentenced Lynn to 16 months, he did it with tongue-in-cheek. His comments showed that he absolutely disliked what he was doing, but he's part of the state police state apparatus. He had to do something.
Steve, I don't know about the Lynn Stewart case, and perhaps some of your readers don't. I mean, some of your listeners don't. What is she accused and imprisoned for?
Well, the charges were wrongfully issued against her, John. She's a longtime human rights lawyer because of
human rights lawyer in the U.S. Wow.
A human rights lawyer for 30 years. She defended the people. She defended society's most unwanted. The kind of people that when prosecutors charge somebody, they automatically want a conviction. Doesn't matter who they are. Lynn took on the kind of people that the prosecutors absolutely wanted to have no justice. They literally declared them guilty by accusation. And Lynn did it because it was the right thing to do. If they couldn't afford to pay for the service, Lynn did it pro bono. She did it for 30
right,
years.
Right, now I'm starting to recall connections.
She's an extraordinary woman, John.
Right,
she's also
right.
A personal friend, so this is a personal issue with me. If I could recount one moment briefly, anyway, that the trial judge turned her down, denied her compassionate release. His reasons were absolutely spurious. They hold no water, whatever. The campaign to free Lynn continues, because if she isn't free, she's going to die in prison. And the one thing she wants is she's going to die someday. She wants to die a free woman. She doesn't want to die behind bars. John, there was a moment I remember some years ago before Lynn was in prison. She came to Chicago to address she had already been charged. She was going through all of this
stuff.
What
was the exact charge?
Well, the charges were that she, oh my God. she was in some way transmitting information from her client illegally. Well, she was part of Ramsey Clark, former U.S. Attorney General's defense team. Ramsey Clark did exactly the same thing that Lynn did. Well, nobody laid a glove on Ramsey Clark, John. They only went after Lynn. I guess they wouldn't dare go after a former attorney general.
Well, yeah, and he's pretty tough and smart and long-time campaigner. But
indeed.
They go after the weak. This is the nature, by the way, just for listeners to know, that my book, which tries to put all of this into context, The Cancer Stage of Capitalism, From Crisis to Cure, has just been released, and it's available throughout the United States as well as throughout the world right now.
Well, John, we have to talk about it on the program.
We'll return to that, but it just sort of, that's the wider context. And the way the cancer system operates, it always picks on just as it does on the micro level, it goes for wherever there's any possibility of invasion and occupation that it can invade.
Oh, absolutely.
It will go there. So with this case, this person is embarrassing through the human rights stands and so forth. The standard thing in the cancer stage of capitalism, the first people who get it are community organizers, human rights organizers, and especially if you can lay a hand on the lawyers. And of course, they're, as you know very well, in fact, they've written very well about it, in Turkey, that's who they went after. They went after the jurists under the phony coup d'etat charge, as well as all sorts of other people. That's who they'll go, they've gone after in Egypt. That's who they go after everywhere, actually on all sides. That's who they go after if they can't. But the fact that she's weak isn't the thing, is that, the warden understood, the administrator understood she needed a compassionate release. Well, for this system, that's exactly where you attack, where it's weak, where it cannot stand up is the first place you attack. So the reason they didn't attack Ramsey Clark is he's able to fight back, has a great name and standing around the world. But Lynn Stewart, as you notice myself, I'm from Canada. I didn't know about the case. I know the nature of the case. And what you're telling me is exactly what happens again and again and again outside the U.S., and now it's happening within the U.S. itself. Human rights lawyers, actual lawyers, are being gone after. And, who better to go after than somebody in the fourth stage of cancer? Who better to go after than somebody who is unable to defend themselves? This is what this system selects for.
John, her cancer was in remission when she was in prison, but she was not in good health when she was in prison, she became ill in prison. She had another operation for another purpose. Now, can you imagine getting an operation in a prison hospital where they just don't give a damn about the patients?
And it's a very, the stress on the immune system is overwhelming.
Oh, it really is. The incident that I wanted to relate just very briefly, I was invited to a National Lawyers Guild meeting to honor Lynn. There were distinguished lawyers there.
Yeah.
I knew only one of them. One of them I knew because I had met him, but the others I didn't know. They also invited students, and they had others come. Maybe about 50, 75 people were there. It was in a law office downtown, and we all waited for Lynn's arrival, and finally she came in sometime after 6 p.m. from O'Hare Airport, Chicago, and I positioned myself so I could see the front door when she came in because I wanted to get hold of her very briefly before others surrounded her and I wouldn't have a chance. And when I spotted her, I immediately jumped up and embraced her, made a few comments, and then she turned the corner and she walked into the room, the main room where they had a reception and some hors d'oeuvres and so on spread out. It's a moment I'll never forget, John, because the lawyers were sitting around or standing and talking. Everybody, as soon as they spotted Lynn, jumped to their feet and applauded. And a lot of this woman, it literally gave me goosebumps to listen to this and see
Wonderful.
It. A very dramatic moment.
Well, she said, this is what you were talking about, change, and what America needs is stand-up people. And Lynn Stewart is one of those stand-up people, and she's paying terribly for it. And by the way, the National Lawyers Guild is the only legal body, really, that you can trust in the United States. it's a very, I don't know whether you've followed its work over the years, but it's a reliably progressive connection of lawyers across the United States who are continually standing up for good causes. And that's too what's needed, is that the people at the top, the people who have the professional expertise as well as the workers and so forth, people who are able to investigate and transmit and explain what's gone terribly, terribly wrong, are the people who have to stand up. And she joins the ranks of the other people we see. And I haven't seen this really since the Vietnam War, where you have Americans standing up for the right against all the vicious activities of the covert and overt state, which is about as vicious a police state apparatus around the world. I haven't seen any such stand-up going on in the U.S. since the Vietnam War. And, you know, we have the Bradley Manning, we have the Edward Snowden, we have the Schwartz, we have Lynn Stewart, we have these people who are, notice the quality of the people. They're not only very brave and courageous, I mean, willing to virtually sacrifice their lives, but they're also very smart. They're also very dedicatedly intelligent, with a really deep understanding of the system and how it really is an evil system. And unless the people inside it who understand it, like these people, stand up, then the U.S. has no hope. But we do see this occurring, one case after another. It's just a matter, I think, you know, at what point do the people get tired of having their heroes, the heroes of the public interest, standing for the common interest, the heroes of those who stand for the common interest, being sacrificed, their lives being terribly sacrificed to this, well, it's hard to say beast, because beast isn't really an adequate concept for what's going on. It's a very virulent system, and that's why the only diagnostic model I can find that is satisfied by, you know, and that is adequate to the facts and the patterns of activity here is a cancer system.
Well, it certainly is, John, and I remember when I read the initial book that came out, I thought the title just really struck the right chord. That's exactly what it is. I mean, it really is malignant. It's destroying the host along with everybody else.
Well, that's my biggest worry. That's why I went after it. You know, I first diagnosed this almost 20 years ago in a public health journal, the basic response to it has been, it gets around and people start to understand it, it won't get any reviews. No one will mention it in official culture. So we have it getting around and obviously resonant with people. People now say yes, whereas before it was sort of seemed just too gigantic an idea to appreciate. Now you find, there's a progressive liberal magazine called The Nation of Change, just was reading an article in there yesterday about the banks and Wall Street and so forth, and their last term was that there was a cancerous system. And I've seen this appearing a lot of places now. The recognition that we have, as you say, and as of course I argue, we have something that endangers the life host, not only of the people of America and of Canada and the people around the world, but the very planetary life host is endangered more deeply. There's nothing. There's no level of life organization that's not under siege by its invasions and occupations, and money sequencing to more, overriding every possible life requirement. So life host is, you're right, life host is what's being threatened here, and life host doesn't mean just you as an individual, because the cancer rates are all going up, interventions are more successful than they have been in the past, but the cancer rates are going up, the obesity rates are going up, all the non-communicable diseases are radically increasing, you as an individual are threatened. Now one out of four people, one out of three people dies of cancer, but it's not just cancer. The cancer system produces all of these non-communicable diseases like diabetes, from obesity and so forth, from junk foods. And so we see it operating at every level where the life host is threatened, not only the individual level, not only on the community level, not only on the nation state level, not on the biospheric regional level, but the very planetary life system itself is under full-scale attack. And it's fracking, for example, just comes to mind. It's a new mode of breaking the earth apart, threatening the groundwater, the very water we drink, our very water supplies, you know, as well as we require not only for drinking, for every purpose, it's the basis of life. That, too, is being threatened. That is being driven, you know, by their system of fracking, and they're just doing it universally now. It's not only the states that are doing it in a huge form. They're doing it in the in Britain as well. Everywhere else they can do it. These same transnational corporate entities are into basically tearing the earth apart as fast as they can do it. And, of course, in Canada, we have the oil sands, which, of course, have become quite notorious around the world because they're the biggest point source of carbon pollution and actually destruction of land in the world. And just to give you an idea of how the immune system is repressed, the immune system is destroyed. Anybody who, you know, tries to do anything about it, we just had the cases of Lynn Stewart and so on, but we also have preemptive that you're not allowed to comment on it. I may have sent you something in the mail where our prime minister, who's just a corporate functionary, but very, very aggressive, operates the country like he's the CEO of Big Oil. He, for anybody who wants to comment on the oil sands, because there's a great uprising occurring inside the country as well as in the U.S. about the oil sands, as well as in Europe, as well as everywhere, because it's dirty oil, as they call it in Europe, and they won't buy it at this point. But, you know, we have a European Canada so-called free trade agreement coming up that dirty oil, you can be sure, will be allowed in. And he requires for anybody who wants to make a comment on this that they have to fill out before the comment will be entertained by any of the relevant authorities and officials in the environmental organization, well, basically the regulatory oversight of the government over this whole enormous project of destruction and extraction. It's a 9-page form you have to fill out before anything you have to say will even be registered as an input. 9 pages of a file of an application. Just, you know, I wouldn't fill out 9 pages. No one, and of course they know that. And then the 9 pages is basically you're trying to prove yourself as qualified to speak on the issue. 9 pages. So they're just stuffing the gag in the mouth before it can speak for the whole country. That's the sort of thing we got going on with the repression of the immune system.
I vaguely remember the applications I had to fill out to apply to colleges so many years ago. It's very easy to forget that time back. But maybe 4 pages, 5 pages, simple stuff, except a couple of places where I had to write paragraphs on why I wanted to attend or what I wanted to do or what my ambitions were or something or other. So I had to sit down and think, put out my thoughts on paper to actually explain why I really wanted to attend.
That probably got you into Harvard, because I know as somebody's assessed a whole lot of faculty and graduate applications, the project description is the key, the research interest is the key. But that's not what they're asking for here. They're just basically trying to stop any comment any way they can, and then they can say, well, you're not qualified to comment. And nobody's qualified to comment unless they're under the pay of the corporation. And so you have, in which more and more university scientists are under the pay of the corporations. In fact, they're trying to make that a systematic, universal format. It's also happening, even I was just just recently refereeing an article for a well-known international journal, and suddenly, for the old system was, you know, you read the article and you give an assessment. Suddenly it had changed to 5 pages of forms where you have to go this place and that place, and you have secret directives, and you have a confidential number, and you, what it is just so typically corporate. Like a cancer that moves, it has to move covertly. It cannot be noticed. And what it's moving is basically stopping anybody from participating in the system who isn't ready to be enslaved to these corporate routines that have absolutely nothing to do with the, you know, the quality of research of the paper, and all to do with keeping everything secret. Not only keeping everything secret, but discouraging anybody who has any, you know, any reason to them and just says, well, I'm just not going to do this. They won't, those people who resist this system, now down to the very forms and memoranda and applications and everything, that's where the real repression is going on invisibly. And then, of course, all the outcome is privately owned by the corporation who has bought the journal, because all the journals now, all the named journals have been bought by big transnational corporations, who then charge, as I've mentioned to you, up to $3,000, $4,000, so the amount keeps going up for anybody to, even for the author himself, to make the matter public. So you have, on the level of applications themselves, you have, or of inputs themselves, this is how the whole technical revolution that we've had through email and so on, which has got so many good aspects to it, this is how you imprison it within routines that require you to become a creature of the corporation and its money sequencing, maximizing activities for no input, no product itself. It takes all this research free. It doesn't pay for a cent of it. It doesn't pay for a cent of the refereeing. All of this is done by people inside higher educational and research institutions because that's part of the job. And so they get it all free, and then they charge the very research, public research institutions that have produced it, then they charge them endless amounts of money to get any access to it. And it's cancerous because it has no committed function, no function whatsoever for the life host. In this case, the life host is the advancement and dissemination of understanding and knowledge, as, you know, verified and validated by other experts in the area. In this case, they're just taking over all of that free of charge and then making it closed to anybody to have access to unless they pay a big price, and they contribute nothing. So it operates like a cancer and multiplying itself, and it's multiplying itself now through all the journals, through all the you know, of course, you know, in pharmaceuticals and medicine, it's now become a public scandal, but it's happening everywhere. And it serves no purpose. It has no function whatsoever. It's just take. Take and slow down the life functions that are available to anything else, which is exactly the way a cancer operates at the micro level. It appropriates the sustenance of the life host's resources to multiply itself with no function. So wherever we look, we see this thing operating. You know, that just came off your mention of applications, you know, and that just seems like such a small thing, application, or a fill out of form. Well, that's become a major, you know, a major front line of repressing all critical response to the system's cancerous advances.
Well, it really is, John, and we both oppose commodifying the things that comprise life's essentials, whether it's health care, whether it's education, whether it's knowledge that should be made public.
These
are
all
things
being made,
that people need.
There's
simply no call at all to commodify these things to make a buck out of them, and making a buck out of them means making as many bucks as possible to rip off as many people for as much as you can get. So you
and to close down the knowledge circuits. It's never worked. It's never worked in terms of advancing knowledge. It blocks knowledge by definition, because the whole key to knowledge is that you have as many people as possible participating who are expert and understand the area in it, and then feeding back in on it, and then you move it along. And that's the way it's always worked with knowledge. Even in the beginning of the United States history, you had the young Benjamin Franklin invented the Franklin stove, for example, and he wouldn't patent it, though he even could in those days. He just said, well, this isn't, you know, knowledge is something that belongs to the public, just as I depended on that knowledge to become informed and to be able to do what I do. So all others do as well, and so you can't possibly put that under private property without stopping the very advance of knowledge itself. Well, what Benjamin Franklin stood for actually, that worked out until basically it all started shifting in the 1980s along with these trade treaty edicts and systems of private, you know, corporate private control of everything with no requirement of any or accountability of any kind to anything but its own profit. Is the Bayh-Dole Act introduced a thing where universities could now privatize their information by patents and copyrights and so forth, and the universities, because they were being corporatized from the inside and they were being defunded from the inside, jumped at it at the corporate top where they're multiplying their salaries, and you had all of the university information now start to be in knowledge production for the public and paid for by public taxes and so forth. All of this now becomes theirs, under their control, and the only way you can do biological research now basically is if you get a corporate partner for it. And the corporate partner sets the agenda. And so it all started within our lifetimes, within our recent lifetimes, that is, if we're old enough, in the later 1980s. And that, of course, is all part of, as I said, a cancer system where you just multiply money sequences, self-multiplying money sequences with no end, no limit, no accountability, nothing but further encroachment and advance. And, of course, more and more taking over all the small firms, predatory competition, eliminating them. So all real business is going out of business or being bought up. As this great sickness advances.
It really is advancing, John, and I can remember, I didn't go to a state college, but when I went to college in the 1950s, there were plenty of state colleges around where you could go to school tuition free. You had your other expenses. If you lived at school, you had to pay for that. You had your own incidental expenses, books and so on. But literally tuition free. And in 1950...
And you had a job, Steve, that you could, in the summer, students could get jobs. If
well,
you had
sure
to pay for,
job.
As you say, the tuition, in fact, the U.S., it was free in state schools. It never reached that level here. Although, by the way, Venezuela, you notice, is free in Scotland and elsewhere, but Venezuela has the most accessible higher education system in the world.
It really does. Right. You can become a doctor in Venezuela free of charge as far as education goes, and you can also do the same thing in Cuba.
Yeah. Yeah, or a professor or whatever. I mean, education is free all the way down and all the way and all the way up. And indeed, in Brazil, which you don't think is as advanced, but Brazil, they have the Bolsa Família program where the mother of a family is paid automatically receives a certain fund as long as her children are registered in school and are going to the clinic. So you make sure that the money isn't just being going down the hole, and with the mothers under control, when they can, and only if they can certify they've been this. That's all they have to do, and then they get this money to make sure their kids are being educated.
It's one of the greatest investments the country can make, John. The GI Bill after World War II in America was an extraordinary investment. The amount of money spent on that, it was something Franklin Roosevelt wanted. He wasn't around to see it. He died before the war was over, months before the war was over, April 1945, I believe. War ended in August. But that GI Bill, for every dollar spent, it returned many multiple times over in educated citizens,
right,
in productivity,
right,
in literally growing the U.S. economy.
Well,
so if America really wanted to grow
made
the
U.S. economy more than anything.
That's exactly right.
Well, why limit it to GI Bill?
Well, I agree with you, John.
Why not have all young people who are qualified and who, and hopefully they, you know, and even be required to do some sort of civil service work, which does happen in places, but that everybody gets to go to college. And in fact, that used to be the way, you know, in Britain. Not only did you get it free, now I'm not sure whether the GI Bill also paid your living expenses, but everybody who was qualified to go to higher education when I did my PhD at in England at University College London, and my classmates and other people who were studying for philosophy were in, you know, lower areas in the PhD were all given a living wage to go to school. That went on until this, the great turn happened with the Thatcher Reagan turn, yes, which you might call the neo-fascist, or I call it the great reversal, which leads to the cancer stage. But that's the way it has been, and that's the way it still is in countries like Venezuela, or as I say, Scotland, where you have this idea, you know how I emphasize life capital is really the basis of everything, and human capital is perhaps the most important form of life capital. You're doing as a society is investing in that, which is your very basis. I hear the music, so...
Yeah, I want to interrupt. We'll take a quick break, John, and hold your thought. We'll come back. Pick it up as soon as we come back. Welcome back, talking with John McMurtry. John, there are so many ways to destroy humanity. You know, you can do it militarily, you can do it politically, you can do it financially, you can do it environmentally. Pick your poison. And if human ingenuity is good at one thing, it's figuring out a way to employ all of these tools, and it really is heading humanity for destruction. You and I may not be around when it happens, but if there isn't a way to stop this madness, I don't know how humanity can possibly survive.
Well, I mean, I think it's already pretty much advanced. The three great monstrous things are, as I think we agree on this, and I think anybody thinking person who knows about it, I'd like to get to Europe, by the way, sometime on this, because this is what's happened to it. We used to have a social democracy, and the big thing is the money sequencing driven from Wall Street, which just gets government money to back up its speculations forever, everything it wants, basically on food prices now, as well as water prices, as well as everything else. So we're moving to a place where there's just complete control given to a Wall Street driven, working through the Bank of International Settlements at the international level, with the top 50 banks are all members of it, and it's basically Wall Street direction. For example, that central banks don't lend to governments. That's a huge thing that also happened just before the 1980s, 1974, basically. Just was a secret directive came out from the Bank of International Settlements to all central banks not to lend to the governments. So then it would all revert to private banks, private transnational banks centered in Wall Street, and they are really the inner drive wheel, the inner driver of the whole sickness. But of course, the military, they require an enforcement mechanism, and the enforcement mechanism is not only an expression of the money sequencing, that is, that you spend $2 billion a day, as you know, in the United States, $2,000 million a day, on basically apparatuses for destroying all opposition to the program. And then you have a corporate trade, international, transnational corporate trade mechanism that is entirely dictated by the corporations themselves and goes under the amusing amusing term of free trade. It's forced trade. Forced trade in these terms where corporations, transnational corporations alone have rights and nobody else has any rights at all. That's just a matter of description. That isn't a polemic. That's just a matter of fact. If you read any of these thousands of pages long with all their dictates of how trade must go on and how the economy must go on. So you have these three monster heads of the system, and they are basically ravenously consuming and destroying everything. You try to find any level of life organization that is not touched by it. I mean, we were just talking about the human capital, which is the very basis of society itself, and the way that you promoted that is by investing in the education of your next generations. I mean, that's just the only thing that's ever worked ever in any society or civilization, and you strip all that. But it's not just there, it's everywhere. I mean, you go to the bottom of the oceans, there's no more big fish left. They've scraped the ocean bottom so that they don't give life anymore. And so you go through, and well, you leap up from the bottom of the oceans to the atmosphere. Well, the climatic and the hydrological cycles have been decycled. And behind every one of them is a common cause, a system mechanism behind every single one of them. And so I would just add to your comment by saying there is no level of life system or organization that is not being invaded and destroyed. Try to think of one.
Boy, I can't think of anything, John. And it's incredible.
And so you go to, I just wanted to get to Europe because I want to even try a thought on you, Steve, that we haven't talked about before. But Europe is in such a, and you were just recently saying about Greece, you thought was in a zombie state. Well, the whole of Europe, in a way, is in a zombie state with the so-called austerity. And, you know, the austerity programs only came in as necessary because of all the public money used to bail out the transnational banks led by Wall Street frauds. That's where it all came from. You have to pay for it. And I wonder about this following strategic plan. The European Union is getting in the way of the U.S. and Wall Street. Though they seem to be cooperating, they are cooperating. In fact, the European bank system is all run by Wall Street graduates, especially Goldman Sachs. That there's a strategic plan, and that is to break Europe itself. Europe is composing a threat in a number of ways. One way, and we haven't talked so much about it, we know about it, is the petrol euro versus the petrol dollar. That is a huge under-discussed thing. That when countries switch, as Iran, for example, has switched, and as Venezuela, and so a lot of countries have switched, and more are on the way, and Iraq was about to switch to the petrol euro, that is the currency in which you buy and sell oil, is euros instead of dollars. Well, the petrol dollar, as you know, has kept the whole U.S. afloat. That's what's replaced the gold standard, is petrol itself. Well, how do you do it since you don't own all the petrol? How are you going to replace the gold standard with petrol? You just make sure that nobody buys and sells oil unless it's in dollar terms, in the same way as you do with money and lending it. But the petrol one was the big one. So then along comes, you know, with all these Middle East crises and so forth, and rebellions and revolutions in Iraq, and, you know, what happens is that all Iran has already gone to the petrol euro, and out of the petrol dollar, that's what is really, not only did they take the oil, but they made sure the oil was exchanged in non-dollar terms. That's the real animus to get Iran, no matter what the change of presidencies, and boy, the president now is sure speaking, you know, he's wanting to be specific and reasonable as possible, but I don't think it is possible because they want that oil dollar back, and they want the oil back, and this is a monster that will do anything to get it. And so we have the euro. Here's friendly Europe, who's operating as the alternative to our petrol dollar. Their countries are moving to it. As I say, Latin America's moved to it, the Middle East has moved to it, but everywhere it moves to it, then it's attacked by the U.S., especially in the Middle East itself. That's the real underlying thing. And the European Union is playing its role in it by providing petrol euros. And so that's one problem. Then there's another problem of Europe. well, basically, as a, it used to have a social democratic society where you had. I mean, Germans, for example, used to have sabbaticals. Their workers used to have sabbaticals like academics. Every one in 7 years, you'd be able to take off at nearly full pay and just do something else to charge your engines of production. And that was how far. And the pensions, of course, were very good, and unemployment security was good, and universal health care was there, and it used to be universal hire, free education, and so on. That's a very bad example to set for the U.S., because here's another industrial developed society with more people than the U.S. in total, and now a bigger economy, and it has a welfare system that really works, and they have a lot of, it's a very complicated but actually effective mechanism, and all, so it represents the threat of an alternative of a Western-style society that you can't say is communist or is terrorist or anything. That just won't wash. So it's really getting in the way there. Here's another one that Europe's done that has gotten it in trouble. I think at the secret, covert geostrategic design, it becomes a great problem to the U.S. Transnational money sequence rule. Is it has a program for chemicals, and how the whole industrial society today depends on new chemicals. There's thousands and thousands of them go in there, and they have all sorts of unpredictable effects and synergies. It has, for 20 years now, it's been developing a program called REACH, R-E-A-C-H, which is an acronym for regulation of all chemicals so that there are no dangerous chemicals left in the whole ecosystem of the chemical reproduction and input into the environment. 20 years they've worked on it. Have you even heard of it?
Probably not. I'm not familiar with it yet.
Yeah. Well, this is huge. This is huge, and they're almost there. And then they're in international trade. They're going to say, well, unless you comply with our regulations, which have been 20 years in the making by the leading scientists and trials and so forth, because right now almost none of those chemicals are tested. And they're certainly not tested for their effects, long-term effects or their synergistic effects. They've tested all of this stuff, and they're going to eliminate up to 1,700 chemicals that are used in industry, saying, no, they're not safe. And of course they aren't safe. They're mostly behind all of these non-contagious diseases that have produced, like cancer and diabetes and so forth, all sorts of chemical concoctions that are not safe. So not only them, but they are really big on that, and they're making regulations so your good can't come in unless it complies with these regulations. Well, what can you imagine what that does to the American chemical, Dow industry and all of the ones that are related with chemicals? I mean, there's no industry that isn't related with chemicals. So Europe is coming up with that. That's been kept very, very quiet, so that I only know it from my specialized research. Almost nobody knows about it, and it's huge, and it's just about to come on board. So you have these three things that Europe represents a big danger on. Maybe not only the petrol dollar converting to the petrol euro, but all the chemical system controls and regulations that they are successfully bringing into play, but most of all, perhaps the social contract model. You always talk about a social contract is what we need, of a different sort. I agree. They have a social contract that they've really minted over the years. I mean, it's quite remarkable how many before this great, after 2008, which you wonder whether 2008 itself wasn't geared not only to make Wall Street rich but to destroy Europe, because now the debt charge is on. All of this austerity is to pay the private banks the debts that they are owed, and all those debts that are owed are driven by ultimately Wall Street and ultimately by Wall Street frauds. And so we are getting rid of the European threat. We're destroying the society. We're dissolving society itself. In Europe. And money's the way we do it. We don't need to do it. As John Foster Dulles says, there's two ways of conquering a country. One is by armed force and the other is by financial means. This is a well-known strategy, and my suspicion is, or as you study geostrategic principles and how they operate in the covert state and so forth, they operate to protect those interests that I've mentioned, which are absolutely basic and dominant in its cancer system. And so what they're going to do is destroy the life host that poses the threat that you can't talk about. Because they're all good things. You can't say they're bad. So what you do is you destroy the society through debt and through austerity programs. And how do you do that? Well, you make all of the countries, like Ireland's a good example. Its banks just blew, you know, and Iceland was a good example, but it turned it around. It refused to pay the banks. Ireland, or if you support the banks, its banks went crazy blending all sorts of money for well past the whole GDP of the country. And then, of course, as their speculations perhaps planned from the center in some way to rip them off. But in any case, all these, especially on mortgages and so forth, you know, that fraud, mortgage fraud of the driven by Wall Street, they just said right away, unbelievable. They said the public, the government, the revenues of the state, that everybody has been taxed for will cover all the private banks' bankruptcies. They will refloat them all. That'll now come straight out of the public's pocket. Well, it was a pure type example of what's gone on everywhere, including, of course, the United States, where basically all this austerity and why there's no jobs and the rest of it is that Wall Street's stolen all the money. And the same thing has happened through their ilk in Ireland and throughout Europe. I mean, Europe, Greece is thought to be a terrible basket case and the rest of it, and, you know, that's pulling Europe down. It's less than 2% of the GDP of Europe. It's just a mask where you use an example where you've stripped this society bare in all sorts of ways, all standard ways, you know. You give away your national, privatize your national resources and public goods, and force workers to lower salaries or fire them in the tens of thousands or strip the social welfare system, strip all social security and education, health, pensions, everything goes down, out, finished. They're destroying society itself. And what are they doing it to do? The pretext is that we must pay down the debt. And how did the debt get formed to begin with? The unspeakable connection. It got formed by the private banking system that the governments have just fallen over and given away the public money to. And that, so the society is being destroyed by a system that the banks, I'm wondering whether the whole thing has been deliberate. Because it sure gets rid of a lot of problems, not only Europe in the ways described, but of the welfare state and the public state itself, the whole civil commons infrastructure of society. It gets rid of any worker power at all. And it leaves you with all the money and other, and governments paying you back, people's paying you back forever for the money you blew. And they're still doing it. They're still giving trillions of dollars. The U.S. is still giving trillions of dollars to the banks to basically, they're not investing it in anything. They're keeping it, you know, there's trillions rolling around in corporate and bank accounts. Now they're not investing in any productive jobs, whatever. They're doing it on derivatives, which, you know, multiply the amount that's already, you know, they're greater than the world's GDP many times over. The amount of money they've got in derivatives, that is just basically stock market betting on what the price will be in the future, which covers everything. It covers food now. It covers water now. It covers everything. They're turning everything into this money sequence system. And, of course, anything that gets in the way, like the European civilization itself that grew up after fascism, that's destroyed too. And it's deliberate.
John,
and I even wonder
that,
you know, you just destabilize. You destabilize and take over. And all that matters is that the banks and the corporations, the transnational money sequences are getting richer and nothing threatens them.
Well, there's nothing to threaten them because they literally run everything. They have their people running Washington with their officials cycling in and out of top positions. So you have Wall Street people running the U.S. Treasury. The bankers decide who will be the Fed chairman. And tomorrow I'll get on an article I wrote about a week ago. I couldn't get it up because I had more time-sensitive stuff, but it looks like Bernanke will step down maybe in January.
Yeah.
I think his term expires in January, and he knows the mess he created, so I think he wants to get out from under before the roof comes down. Whether he'll make it in time, who knows? But the man that Obama apparently wants is Larry Summers. So I have a scathing article just tearing him apart from end to end. I can't imagine the worst choice.
He's evil. He's gotten very rich, you know, by all this
stuff. Oh, he's a multimillionaire.
Yeah.
And he's made millions of dollars. He's done it through fraud and scamming and the same kind of stuff that he supported as Treasury Secretary that at the end of the Clinton administration, he was responsible for pushing through the end of Glass-Steagall.
Yeah.
So, you
know,
the banks could get into any kind of a monkey business they wanted to.
Yeah.
And,
people's savings,
Yeah, and the Derivatives Proliferation Act, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, that opened up the tsunami of speculative derivatives trading, and that really, as much as anything, caused the crisis of 2008.
Absolutely, and it's still going strong. And
it really is.
I mean, the Volcker Rule, it just wants to introduce some version of Glass-Steagall back, is being stopped in Congress, too, and of course, a guy like him, the fact that that guy is even up, is even being talked about as, and he was for a while the favorite, that talked about as a favorite for the Federal Reserve Chair, it boggles the mind
that they
can get away with anything.
If the bankers want him,
the
they're going to get him.
And the guy who did it, who led it, he's going to be even more senior in his control of money for self-enrichment and Wall Street enrichment. And then the only thing, what I think is going on there, though, is that possibly that Janet Yellen is being touted as a candidate instead, because they're using, if Obama has any brains, he would use Larry, he would use that guy as sort of a way of getting his way on the appointment he wants. Janet Yellen is a sort of more middle-of-the-road figure, you know, San Francisco Federal Board and also a professor of economics and so forth. She's a more moderate type, but I can't believe, though, that Larry Summers is even being proposed. It makes the mind real, like you're in a dreamland. It's a dream sequence going on here. How can this be? What do you think? Do you think it'll go to, it seems to me inconceivable that he can get that job after everything that you know, which is more public knowledge than most of what you write about.
John, the only possibility of stopping him, if there is mass public outrage great enough to really be a groundswell, but I don't see it. That was one of the main reasons I wrote my article, to get people to know what kind of a scumbag this guy is.
Yeah.
But we literally went from bad to worse. I mean, Greenspan was absolutely nightmarish. In my Wall Street book, I had a chapter about him. I talked about Bernanke in my Banker Occupation book. So we went from bad to worse, and now we may hit rock bottom with a Larry Summers.
Well, I agree. I mean, he'll just continue the stuff that they've sold to Europe. You know what's happening in Europe, because that's Wall Street in a way, in another form, because it's their alumni that run the place. And how they've taken over is really amazing. I mean, just how have they done that? But they have a European stability mechanism, and you know what that allows them to do? It allows them to do what they've done in the past as a matter of law, that the mechanism and the office in charge of it, which is a sub-branch of the European Central Bank, is allowed to, and of course it'll do just what Ireland did. It's allowed to draw, not only depending on Ireland, they had to buy the politicians first. You don't have to buy the politicians anymore. Under the so-called stability mechanism, you can take the money straight out of the accounts of governments to do what you want with it, which has always been 100% giving it to the private banks.
Well, it goes to
the
private banks.
You can take it right out. That's what it actually, and then it says, in this law, which I think Ellen Wood has written about, in this law, not only can they take any money they want from national accounts to do what they want with, which is always to give to the private transnational banking system, but they can, there's no possible legal recourse of any government or people against it. is all ruled out that you can ever have a lawsuit or you can ever have a complaint or that you can ever raise it in the European Parliament or that there ever can be a discussion of the issue. It's ruled out.
And it's ruled out that bankers can do no harm, John. Once in a while they prosecute somebody, and I just wrote about one of the star Goldman Sachs traders who was prosecuted and convicted. Well, he'll appeal. However, it turns out, it really amounts to nothing because the company was prosecuted and pleaded guilty and paid a $500 million fine in 2010. Sounds like a lot of money, John.
Yeah.
It amounted to 4 revenue days for Goldman Sachs the same year.
Yeah.
4 revenue-producing days. So in other words, Goldman gets a license to steal tens of billions of dollars, and they pay pennies back in a fine. And it was a civil case. There were no criminal charges filed.
Yeah.
There were no criminal charges filed against this arch trader involved in this stuff. That's the way the dirty game works. A quick final comment, John.
Well, the cancer system, the global cancer system, needs to be recognized for the planet and humanity to survive.
Indeed so. I wish you were going to stress it on this program. John, it was great having you back. I look forward to next month. Join us every Friday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Weekends, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.